From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Fifty years ago, the radioactive monster Godzilla emerged from the ocean and stomped across Tokyo, breathing fire and destroying the city. In honor of the film's anniversary, the original Japanese version has been released in America for the first time, with no Raymond Burr, but more about the H-bomb. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Steve Reifel, the author of a biography of Godzilla. The World of Architecture's top honor, the Pritzker Prize, will be awarded on Monday to Iraqi-born architect Zaha Hadid. She's the first woman to win the Pritzker. We'll talk about her work. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD featuring saxophonist Fred Anderson and drummer Hamid Drake. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Attorney General John Ashcroft says the U.S. government has credible intelligence that terrorists plan an attack in the United States. But he said there were no specifics about where or when, and that the government was not raising the terror alert level at this time. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The attorney general's warning followed weeks of concern by U.S. officials that al-Qaeda could attack sometime this summer and fall when several high-profile events such as the political conventions are being held. Ashcroft said recent reports about a possible attack were credible and based on multiple sources.
This disturbing intelligence indicates al-Qaeda's specific intention to hit the United States hard. Beyond this intelligence, al-Qaeda's own public statements suggest that it's almost ready to attack the United States.
He said these included a statement after the March train bombings in Madrid that the group had completed 90% of its planning for an attack in the United States. Ashcroft also asked for the public's help in tracking down seven suspected al-Qaeda operatives. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
An Oklahoma jury has convicted Terry Nichols for the murder of 161 people in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Nichols could face the death penalty for his part in the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building. The jury will begin deciding on Tuesday whether to recommend execution or life in prison. U.S. Army troops battled Shiite militia in the Iraqi city of Najaf today. American troops also captured a close aide of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from Baghdad.
American soldiers backed by heavy armor and air support fought Shiite fighters in and around a giant historic cemetery not far from Shiite holy shrines. At least 10 people were killed and another 30 wounded in combat overnight and part of the day. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett said today U.S. forces continue to constantly chip away at Sadr's militia. Kimmett said recent fighting in Najaf and the Sadr city district of Baghdad had killed, quote, a very large number of Sadr's militia. Army forces also captured Riyad al-Nuri in an overnight raid. Nuri is a relative and close aide to Sadr. Meantime, an ambush near a Baghdad power plant killed two Russian engineers and prompted their company to make plans to pull entirely out of Iraq. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Baghdad.
Four nations are reportedly proposing significant changes to the draft resolution on Iraq that was put forward by the U.S. and Britain. China outlined the proposal, and the Associated Press quotes diplomats as saying it's supported by Russia, France, and Germany. The plan would give Iraq's interim government the right to decide whether foreign troops should remain in the country and would end the multinational mandate in January of 2005. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 7 points to close at 10,109 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 11 to 1976. This is NPR News. Two car bombs have exploded in the Pakistani city of Karachi, 200 yards from the U.S. consulate. Officials say a policeman was killed and two dozen other people were hurt. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from New Delhi.
The first blast happened outside an English language school called the Pakistan American Cultural Center. Police and the local media had just arrived to view the impact when a second car detonated. Journalists and police officers were reportedly among the injured. Karachi's seen repeated violence, some sectarian, some by Islamist militants. The city was already on edge after a bombing Tuesday killed one person, and also after the arrest of six alleged militants accused of the attempted assassination of President Pervez Musharraf in 2002. Musharraf is opposed by Islamist militants for supporting the U.S. offensive against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. The twin bombings were only a few hundred yards from the U.S. consulate. A senior Pakistani official says they may have been the work of al-Qaeda. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Senator John Kerry says he will accept the Democratic presidential nomination at his party's convention in Boston in July. Kerry had been considering delaying his acceptance in order to have more time to raise and spend campaign money. Once he accepts the nomination, Kerry will be limited to spending about $75 million in public money that's been set aside for the general election. President Bush is also expected to use the public funding, but he won't be renominated until 5 weeks after Kerry, giving him that much more time to raise and spend donations. Kerry said he'll continue to explore ways to, in his words, level the playing field. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR shop features an assortment of clothing, mugs, and other NPR gear selected especially for public radio listeners. At npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Godzilla was king of the monsters, and the movie was king of all monster movies. But the Godzilla that Americans have seen is considerably different from the original Japanese movie. In honor of its 50th anniversary, the film has been released here for the first time in its original version. It's much more than a campy or scary monster movie. It's a very bleak, somber film with echoes of the firebombing and atom bombing of Japan and direct references to the perils of radiation. Probably know the basic story. A giant and angry reptile emerges from the ocean and stomps across Tokyo, breathing fire and destroying the city. The American version of the film deleted about 40 minutes from the original to make it shorter and to make way for new footage that was added to make the film more marketable to American audiences. The new footage featured an American wire service reporter whose reports provide the narration for the story. The reporter was played by Raymond Burr, who went on to play Perry Mason. Here's how he opened the film.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world. There were once many people here who could have told of what they saw. Now there are only a few.
My guest Steve Riefel is the author of a book about the making of Godzilla and its many sequels. It's called Japan's Favorite Monster. I asked him why Raymond Burr's character was added to the American version and why some of the film's message was changed.
Well, this was, the mid-50s, a decade or so after the end of the war. I don't think there was a lot of sympathy for Japan, so the underlying message of the film may not have resonated so well with American audiences at that time. That having been said, I don't know that the distributors of the film in the United States had purely political motives. I think they were driven more by capitalism than anything else. And what they did was essentially disguise a Japanese film as an American one. And if you think about it, what they did was rather ingenious. They rented Raymond Burr for one day. The story goes that they paid him for one day's work and they kept him at the studio for 24 hours in order to film all of his scenes. They filmed everything in a little on a little soundstage on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles. They hired Asian actors, some of whom posed as essentially body doubles for the Japanese actors. They used over-the-shoulder shots and whatnot to kind of pretend that Raymond Burr was actually speaking to members of the Japanese cast. And they rather effectively, if crudely, incorporated him into the Japanese film. And what it did was it created a very marketable giant monster movie of the variety that was so popular at that time.
Now, the ending is really changed. In the original Godzilla, the Japanese movie that is being released now in its full version in the States, the movie ends with the paleontologist saying, "I can't believe that Godzilla is the only survivor of his species. If we continue testing H-bombs, another Godzilla will one day appear somewhere in the world." What's the ending in the American version?
Well, You know, the giant bug, giant reptile, you know, atomic monster movies were extremely popular in the 1950s. I mean, I could run down a list of really wonderful titles like Tarantula, Them, Black Scorpion, Giant Claw, Giant Gila Monster, Giant Behemoth, The Amazing Colossal Man, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, and on and on and on. And what was the normal pattern in those films? Essentially, in the American atomic monster movies, the monsters were stand-ins for Cold War invaders. And at the end of the movie, there would be much celebration as the American military ultimately defeated these warriors, these monsters, with new and more powerful military might. Often there would be, you know, a new version of an atomic weapon that obliterated the monster. And the message was clear that no matter what the threat, you know, never fear, the American military is strong and will defend you. And what the American distributors of Godzilla did was essentially, if not completely, attempt to create an ending of that type. Raymond Burr's last line of the film was, you know, the menace was gone, but the whole world could wake up and live again. I think even in the Raymond Burr version of the film, the rather downbeat and poignant ending still shines through to a point. But in the original version, as you said, it's much more pessimistic. If we continue to test these H bombs, another Godzilla is going to appear somewhere in the world someday. To me, what that essentially means is, in our world, that someday, you know, one of these bombs is going to be used again. And if you look around us today, I mean, it's never been more true. I mean, we're just one accident away from a nuclear tragedy. And incidentally, the scientist's prediction was correct, wasn't it? Godzilla came back again and again and again and again. And that's why we're here talking about this today.
You know, watching the movie as an adult, I was thinking, well, you know, it's the H-bomb that's responsible for Godzilla, but it's the atomic bomb that was actually dropped on Japan. Why is it the H-bomb that the movie is so concerned with?
Well, the H-bomb testing program was in full effect at this time, and there was an incident in early 1954, the Lucky Dragon tragedy, and this is really the incident that may have been, you know, the most responsible for the creation of Godzilla. The Lucky Dragon was a Japanese fishing boat that set sail from its home port in Yaizu in January of 1954, and its voyage was ill-fated from the beginning. They were originally set to tuna fish in the waters off of Indonesia, but at the last minute, the owner of the boat ordered the fishing master to set sail instead for the waters off of Midway because he'd heard that there was great catches of albacore tuna to be had there. So in late February, they began fishing there, and on the morning of March 1st, 1954, in the pre-dawn hours, a few crew members were standing on the deck when they thought they saw the sun rising in the west. And what it turned out to be was an H-bomb test. Now, the crew of the boat had not been warned that they were drifting dangerously close to the Pacific Proving Ground, the H-bomb testing zone at the Marshall Islands. And even if they had known that they were close to the testing ground, they certainly did not know that a test was going to occur on that date. So as they stood there wondering what the heck this was, a few of the men who had served in the war started to get an eerie feeling, and the captain said, "Let's get the heck out of here." And by the time they reeled in their nets, they were being rained on with this sticky white ash, this radioactive fallout. And by the time they got back to Japan, many of the men were sick. The radio man later died of leukemia that year. It became a huge international incident. And in mid-March, after the boat had returned to port, and it was starting to be, this incident was starting to make waves in the press, Tomoyuki Tanaka, the producer of the film eventually, clipped a newspaper article and went to the head of production at Toho Studios and said, "What if these nuclear tests, what if these H-bomb tests awakened an undersea creature that came on land and destroyed Japan?" And that's really the genesis of Godzilla.
There are amazing scenes of destruction in Godzilla. You know, Godzilla in the movie, he's not just a victim of the hydrogen bomb, a victim in the sense that he's become bizarre and radioactive as a result of this, but he also is a kind of like metaphor for the force of hydrogen and atom bombs. And, you know, he breathes fire and he sets Tokyo ablaze. And the scenes of Tokyo burning are really disturbing, especially if you're a child watching it. Can you describe how those scenes were shot?
Well, the miniature sets of Tokyo, in some cases, were so large that they had to be built outside to accommodate the width and the dimensions of them. They were basically shot using miniature buildings constructed in 1/25th scale. And, of course, Godzilla, as we all know, is a man in a latex costume who tramples through the set. For instance, when Godzilla destroys the clock tower in the Ginza, that is a very, very accurately detailed model. You know, often people will deride these films for being, quote-unquote, cheap, simply because they do not use the stop-motion animation technique that other giant monster films before them did use. That being said, the amount of care and detail that went into the construction of the miniature Tokyo is just amazing. When you witness Tokyo on fire, there's a great shot during the middle of Godzilla's long rampage. It's just amazing. The destruction, the death toll, is sort of unparalleled on screen.
Of course, the American version of Godzilla, the one with Raymond Burr, was dubbed. And over the years, a lot of people have, you know, mocked the dubbing of that and many other monster movies. How was the dubbing done? How much preparation did the actors have for this? How carefully selected were the actors?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is the American version of the film we're talking about, actually doesn't have a whole lot of dubbing. I mean, the whole device of inserting Raymond Burr into the film was a way of getting around that, because Raymond Burr essentially is not the protagonist. He is a commentator, a narrator. And basically what he does is observe the story and then tell you what the Japanese characters are doing, as if you were too stupid to figure it out for yourself. But nevertheless, there is some dubbing. The dubbing for Godzilla King of the Monsters is an exceptional case because it was very crude. I talked to some of the actors who worked on it, including James Hong, who is a very recognizable character actor who played the villain in Big Trouble in Little China. He's a very recognizable actor, and this was one of his first professional gigs. And he said they didn't even have the luxury of, you know, looping against the film while they saw it, you know, projected on a screen. They basically were given a script and sat down in front of a microphone and asked to read all their lines at various different speeds so that later on somebody could pair them up with the lip movements on the screen. But most of the Godzilla movies that are lambasted for the dubbing are the ones released in the 60s with titles like Destroy All Monsters and Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster and Monster Zero. Those films mostly were dubbed by professional actors. People like Hal Linden worked on some of those films because they were mostly dubbed by a company called Titra in New York. And they employed, stage actors who were, you know, free during the day. That's how some of them made, a decent living during that time period.
My guest is Steve Riefel, author of the book Japan's Favorite Monster. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Riefel, the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. The original Japanese version of Godzilla has just been released in America for the first time. One of the things that really intensifies all the effects of Godzilla, the sense of danger, the sense of destruction, is the score. It's a fantastic score. And worked into the score are the sounds of the monster growling and the really frightening sounds of the monster's footsteps reverberating. Tell us something about the composer of the score.
Well, Akira Ifukube, boy, what can I say? I think the score for Godzilla, of course I'm biased, but I think it's one of the greatest film scores of all time. And of course, the motifs in Godzilla were reused and reworked continually throughout the golden age of the series in the 50s and the 1960s. Mr. Ifukube is a highly regarded classical composer in Japan. He scored many, 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 many films, including several classics. And, you know, without Ifukube's music, I don't think Godzilla would have made the impact that it did. the music is synonymous with Godzilla, as is Godzilla's roar, which, by the way, Mr. Ifukube created through the manipulation of musical instruments and sound effects.
Why don't we hear part of the score, and you'll hear the monster's footsteps and the monster's roar worked into it. Music from the soundtrack of Godzilla. The sound of Godzilla's footsteps have always seemed to me to be the sound of impending doom, you know, because it's this thunderous, reverberating sound, and you get the feeling it's coming closer, you know, and so that's the feeling you're always left with when you hear these footsteps. It's like, it's coming closer. The monster or the tragedy is approaching. How are those footsteps created?
Well, there are several accounts of how that was done. It seems to have been the most logical explanation seems to be a large drum that was beat and recorded and, you know, reverb effects added to it. I don't think it was anything, you know, technically sophisticated at that time. This film really had a make-it-up-as-you-go-along, you know, approach. Whatever needed to be done, the filmmakers found a way to do it.
How was the monster's roar created?
The monster's roar, boy, isn't that one of the greatest sound effects in movie history? Every kid knows it. I remember when I was a child, we used to try to imitate it, too. Not too much success. It was created by rubbing a gloved hand, a leather-gloved hand, over the strings of a double bass, recording that sound and manipulating it, changing the speed. And that's what they came up with. And Godzilla's roar basically was created using the same sound effects, even up until now. Now it's digitally altered, but it basically sounds the same. If you recall, during the 1960s, Godzilla's roar became more of a high-pitched whine, but it's more or less the same sound.
Do you think that the director of Godzilla, Ishiro Honda, saw it as a monster film or saw it as, you know, a parable about the dangers of nuclear weapons?
I think it's a little bit of both. Mr. Honda had served in the Japanese military during World War II, and upon his return home after the war, he had visited Hiroshima and witnessed the aftermath of the destruction there, and he was deeply affected by that, and he said so on several occasions. Godzilla is Mr. Honda's most personal film by far, and you can see the imprint that the war left on him. He worked personally on the script. You know, and he spoke many, many times over the years about how his desire for this film, while it was an entertainment film by and large, but his desire was to send a message, not an indictment of America. The monster really, that's another difference between Godzilla and American monster movies of the same time period. The American monsters usually are stand-ins, as I said, for Cold War enemies. Godzilla is not really a stand-in for America. It is more an indictment of the nuclear age, and Honda's hope was that somehow this film would inspire people to think about disarmament. I think today, if he were still alive, he'd be very disappointed that, you know, nuclear weapons are possessed by more nations than ever before.
Do you remember the first time you saw Godzilla?
I do.
When was it, where was it, and how old were you?
You know, I have a wonderful mother. Patricia, I love you. And I would never have discovered Godzilla if it weren't for her. I remember the first time I ever heard the word Godzilla. I was probably about 4 years old, and we were flipping channels. And my mother stopped on one channel, and there was a dinosaur walking through a city. And I already loved dinosaurs. And my mother said, that's Godzilla. Well, it wasn't Godzilla. It actually was the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and once she realized that, she changed the channel. But the word Godzilla stuck in my brain, and I really wanted to know what it was, and you know, and she had told me the story of when Godzilla, King of the Monsters, first came out. She left work and went to a theater near her office, or the company where she worked, went to go see it, and I was just intrigued. And I remember scouring the TV guide, and you know how we used to do in those days, you'd look through the listings, and the first time I located, you know, Godzilla, I stayed up until, you know, the middle of the night and watched it. Those things used to air in, you know, the pre-dawn hours in those days.
You've seen all of the Godzilla sequels. Which do you think are the worst?
Well, the film that is fairly universally regarded as the worst of the Godzilla series is called Godzilla vs. Megalon. And, you know, this film has unfortunately been probably seen more widely than any other Godzilla film. It came out in 1973 in Japan, 76 roughly in the United States. And NBC actually broadcast it in prime time with John Belushi hosting it and introducing segments of the film wearing a Godzilla costume himself. It's pretty much widely known as a terrible film. Godzilla and a giant robot fight two other creatures, one of whom is a giant cockroach with drill bits for arms. The other is a cyborg alien buzzard with a buzzsaw in its stomach. It's crudely made. It's a lot of fun for laughs, but it's really not science fiction, you know, in any sense of the word. And yet this film really has massive exposure, relatively speaking. And I think a lot of people who just assume Godzilla is this campy, you know, monster that is good for little more than wrestling matches and goofy antics are thinking of films like this one. That's why the release of this, the original Godzilla in its uncut form, in this, you know, quote-unquote director's cut version, is so important. Because Godzilla didn't start out that way. It had serious intentions. And yes, it's an entertainment film. Yes, it's not meant to be taken too seriously. We're not talking about, you know, Citizen Kane here. I recognize that. But nevertheless, the original film and the filmmakers who created it had higher aspirations than something like Godzilla versus Megalon. And let us not forget that.
Well, Steve Riefel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Steve Riefel is the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. The original Japanese version of Godzilla has just been released in America for the first time in honor of the film's 50th anniversary. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble. Now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Beyond Belief by Elaine Pagels, author of The Gnostic Gospels. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On Monday, the Iraqi-born architect Zaha Hadid will receive the Pritzker Prize, architecture's top honor. She's the first woman to win it. Coming up, we talk with her about her work. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new collaboration between saxophonist Fred Anderson and drummer Hamid Drake. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Monday, architecture's highest honor, the Pritzker Prize, will be awarded to Zaha Hadid, who was born in Iraq in 1950 and now lives in London. She's the first woman to receive the Pritzker. She'll receive the medallion and $100,000 at the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. Although her work has been very influential, it's only recently that her designs have actually been made into buildings. Earlier this year, a profile of Hadid for the New York Times Magazine by Herbert Muchamp said, Hadid has been my personal Alfred Hitchcock movie for roughly 20 years. At times, the suspense has been unbearable. Would Hadid become a builder, or was she destined to remain celebrated as the designer of some of the greatest architecture never built? I talk with Hadid about her work. First of all, I want to congratulate you on a belated congratulations for winning the Pritzker Prize this year. Now, let's get to your first American building, which is the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, which was completed in May of 2003. Is an art museum, a contemporary art museum, a good place to try adventurous design?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that I think it's always interesting to try this art on, not just as an experiment, but I think that it's suitable because, you know, it dealt in this case with the whole idea of movement and the urban context and the idea of civic space. And I think civic buildings, you know, lend themselves well to this kind of, you know, let's say, research. But I think also one can equally say you can test that out on ideas of housing, which actually people have not touched on for a very long time. And how the public housing in a city can have an influence on the street. I mean, so I think that it's not because, this understanding it, because the ideas are kind of a bit crazy that it's suitable to only art institutions. I think they could be translated equally well for, you know, corporate work or for housing or parks or whatever.
Would you describe the Contemporary Art Museum in Cincinnati that you design?
Well, I mean, I think that what was interesting about it, it's a very tight site. So most of our work is sometimes horizontal, like it deals with layers and so on. So this is a stacked building, and the idea that you stretch the space of the museum vertically. The one thing which we try to do was to kind of really provide a very nice public space as an indoor room on the ground, which allows you people to only propel to the building, but also that the building connects to the street in a good way, and therefore allows people to move through it in a seamless way. So it's like a series of rooms which are juxtaposed over each other and next to each other to allow these kind of spaces to be in concrete or in metal or in glass to allow light to come through the building, which is not, you don't see just kind of a solid object. And this idea of the transparency and the kind of geometry together provide a kind of an interesting interpretation of that space.
So you have all kinds of rooms of different shapes and sizes and with different types of light so that whatever piece they're showing at the moment, they could find a good setting for it.
Yeah, you can have a kind of object in a very tall room, or you can have a video installation in another kind of space, and there's already provided. You don't have to kind of really invent partitions and stuff like that. But I mean, the museum is quite compact, and one thing which it has on the top level is an unmuseum, which is for children, where you can commission three-dimensional objects or spaces for, like, a children's museum, where you can touch and play with and stuff like that. And that was really also great fun.
Now, you've designed a science center for Wolfsburg, Germany, and that's nearing completion. I think when people think of science centers, they think of very futuristic design. Would you describe your design for this building?
Well, there's a kind of concrete building which is lifted off the ground. And I think the most interesting part about it, it has many kind of aspects. One thing which is very interesting about it is that if you imagine that the ground is empty, and then there are these very large cones in concrete which become the entrances, the theater, the restaurant. So you have an activity on the ground the whole in the evening and the day. And when it lifts up, it becomes one continuous space for the exhibit. So basically it's like a large table, let's say, with very big legs, and the legs they have program, and it makes them active the whole day and the whole evening. And then the top of the table with a roof is where the museum is.
So the legs are cone-shaped?
their legs are kind of like cones, but they obviously don't have a point because they have a program. For example, one is a kiosk, one is a bookshop, one is a shop, one is a laboratory, one is a theater, one is restaurants and cafes. And the intention is that always, and mostly there are entrances. I mean, so you arrive there and you go up escalators or lift to the main plateau where all the exhibits are.
So it's like four buildings connected by the roof.
Yeah, like 7-8 cones, and they're all connected by a roof, and then there's another roof which covers the top of the table.
And what was the advantage of having them be separate but connected?
Well, first of all, the ground, I mean, we have, in terms of the urbanism, there was the city and there was the Volkswagen factory, which is on the other side, and there was a train station, and the idea was kind of to create paths through the building on the ground. So these paths, are not, the building doesn't block the path, so the idea is you can move from the station to the Autostadt, from the Autostadt to the city. And these paths also make the parameters of these cones. And then you can move up through the building. So the idea that the ground is really belongs to the city, and therefore you can spill out from the restaurants and you can hang out there, and then as you move up, you go into the museum.
That sounds nice. If you're just joining us, my guest is the architect Zaha Hadid, and she won this year's Pritzker Prize, which is the top international prize for architecture. You grew up in Iraq. You were born in Baghdad in 1950. Now, I know you don't like to talk about the war or current politics, but I was hoping we could talk a little bit about some of the things that influenced your sensibility when you were growing up. First of all, as a woman, I'm wondering if you were, when you were a girl, if you were encouraged or discouraged about thinking in terms of a career, particularly such a male-dominated one as architecture.
No, I was always encouraged. I mean, not only by my parents, but by the school itself. I mean, I was talking yesterday that you know, all my contemporaries are, I don't know, a single one who's not a professional. And I mean, I think there's this view that because you are from the Arab world, you know, I think it's a kind of a, not an accurate, let's say, perception. Particularly in Iraq, you know, where many women went into university and higher degrees and worked in variety of professional aspects of life. So I was always encouraged, let's say, both by my parents and by the school. And with the school, I went to a non-school, a Catholic non-school, although I'm a Muslim, but which was kind of a very tough school. And quite demanding academically, and I'm very grateful to them because I think that all that work in those years kind of made it possible for me to kind of really, let's say, do better.
Did your parents believe in modernity or tradition or some balance of the two?
I think they both believed in modernity, and particularly my father. I mean, both my parents believed in modernity. I think another thing which I think is... in the Arab world, I mean, the whole connection between Islam and the Arab world is so integrated and so intertwined, and it doesn't really matter whether you are Muslim or Christian or Jewish. If you live in the Arab world, that the dominant force is culturally is kind of Islamic, although it's not religious necessarily all the time. And so my parents were always very liberal and open and not necessarily tradition in any way.
My guest is Zaha Hadid. On Monday, she'll receive the Pritzker Prize, architecture's top honor. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Zaha Hadid, the first woman to win the Pritzker Prize, architecture's top honor. The award ceremony is on Monday. Your father was one of the leaders of the Iraqi Democratic Party. How did your family's life change when Saddam Hussein came to power?
Well, I mean, I think that there were so many changes in Iraq. I mean, I think in 63 and then in 68. I mean, my parents decided to stay in Baghdad and that was their choice. I mean, in a way, everybody's life was affected by these political changes, you know, but they decide that that's where they live and they're not going to leave, and I was abroad. So I really can't, you know, speculate how it changed, because I wasn't witnessing what they were doing on a daily basis. But I think all our lives changed because we had so many coups in Iraq, and it kind of constantly affected us.
Where were you going to school at the time? What country were you in?
I was in the late 60s. I was already out. I was in Beirut, I think,
mm-hmm.
or in London. In London.
Did your family stay in Iraq?
Oh, yeah, they did. I used to go back every year till the early 80s. I used to go back for holidays.
Why did you stop going in the early 80s?
Well, I think after the Iran war, it became very difficult to go back. And after the Gulf War, there was no mode of transportation to Baghdad. I mean, the airport was closed. You had to go via Jordan. You have to spend 16 hours on a car to go there, and I didn't go back.
It will seem odd, I think, to some of our listeners, that given everything Saddam Hussein has done, I'm going to ask you a question about his architecture. But, I mean, one of the things that Saddam did was commission monuments to himself. And some of them, from the pictures I've seen, just seem extraordinarily kitschy. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on the Saddam Hussein-era architecture, particularly his monuments to himself.
I haven't really seen them, so I can't, you know. I mean, I've seen them
in
photographs.
Right, you've seen them in photographs. Okay.
But, I mean, one can say the same thing about North Korea, I suppose, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
parts of Germany. I mean, I don't think it... I mean, I don't believe in monuments personally. I don't think they add to the culture of a place. I mean, I think they're kind of delicate, these things, because they do represent a political view. And so whether one should do them or not is a bigger topic, let's say.
Saddam Hussein had the money to commission, you know, some spectacular buildings and pay various architects from around the world a lot of money to design them. And would you examine the politics of a country's leader before accepting a commission there? Or is that the wrong way to go about it, do you think?
I think it's very difficult to accept commissions from various countries, but I mean, one has to kind of then, one would say that nobody should work in so many other places in the planet. So,
right.
I think it depends on what the commission is. If somebody asked me to do housing there, I would, you know, for the indigenous population, and if that improves their life, then I have to think about it one way. If I'm asked to do something else, I have to think about it in a different way. I don't think it's going to blanket question answer situation.
Now, you said that most of the girls who grew up within Iraq became professionals. They went into careers. That there was nothing that stood in your way of doing that growing up in Iraq.
No.
Once you became an architect and you were working, I think, throughout your career, you've been working in London, did being a woman stand in your way as an architect?
Oh, it has. A lot.
How do you think?
Well, I think that there are more women architects now, so that kind of the whole, kind of idea that women can't do it, can do it, has been, you know, lifted, let's say, that prejudice. You know, if I went to a meeting with an assistant of mine to a side, they will talk to him and not talk to me. If I was were to meet kind of politicians, when I was in the Cardiff Opera House, I think the big problem was I was a woman and foreign and did this other stuff. So I think it does. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, there's a world which you, as a woman, no matter how successful you are, you can't enter into. You're not part of a network. You know, it takes you a long time, let's say, to come over these things. I mean, I never thought it would be a problem because, as I said, you know, for a good reason or bad reason, I always thought, you know, I should do well because the work is good. And that was the focus, is on the investment in the work and not into politicking for whatever other things. So I was quite surprised and shocked when all these, you know, prejudices began to emerge. And it comes, I come across it less these days, but it's still there.
How did you manage to support yourself and your employees during the years that you were designing buildings that weren't actually getting built?
Well, we always had a project. We won many competitions, and so we had some income. I was teaching, that financed the office, or gave many lectures. But then, in a way, we're commissioned to do the housing in Berlin. We're commissioned to do the housing, the project in Vitra for the fire station and another pavilion and many installations and exhibitions. And it was very tight and extremely difficult to survive. But, it, you know, I don't know how we managed. It was with tremendous difficulty. It was only juggling between teaching and lecturing and also some of these commissions. I mean, we're not really sitting in the office, you know, knitting.
How do you like the commissioning system in architecture? It seems like, on the one hand, it must seem very fair on the one hand and very frustrating on the other, because you're always having to design buildings as if you were actually going to build them, but chances are you're not going to build them because it's a competition and only one company is going to win it.
Well, I think I personally like competitions because they do lift the standard. You know, also it's a public event, so people know about the project. They know about the site. They know about the story. It's not always fair when whom they choose, but let's say it's. I mean, anyway, I've been grateful to the system because if it wasn't for competition, I would not have any work. Very little, you know. It was only because in the last 5 years, I won quite a few, and my first project, The Peak, which was I won in 83, was the one which propelled me into the scene, let's say, was another competition, which was a very big competition. Now these competitions are much smaller and more invited and, let's say, less open. But I still believe in a system, you know. It's not always fair, but I still think it's... haven't had the privilege of actually being commissioned directly to do projects so many. I'm more so now, but it's not been so easy.
No, I want to ask you a question about design of a different sort, and this is clothing design. People who write about you always point out that you wear Issey Miyake clothes, and I'm wondering how important the design of clothes is to you as somebody who, you know, is so caught up in designing architecture.
Well, you know, I think it's. I mean, I think it's fun to dress. You know, when I was in school in London, I used to kind of wrap myself in, you know, fabrics and funny stuff like that. I mean, let's say, I think it's a balance of not being a fashion victim, but to wear something which, you know, you feel comfortable in and you enjoy wearing. You know, I think it's really the bottom line. It's not about making some sort of statement about, you know, that you're wearing cheap or expensive clothes or a particular thing because it's fashionable. I think it's important to actually be able to express yourself the way you dress. And this might be something you design or someone else has designed. And Issey Miyake is particularly, I have a tremendous respect for him. And Yoji, actually, the Japanese are particularly good. And they're easy to travel with. They're very light. They can kind of compact. They crush into a small, you crumble them into a small corner of a suitcase. You can carry lots of things with you when you're traveling. When you're having your hotel, you don't have to iron them. They're perfect when you open them. So there's all these things which have to do with, on one hand, practical issues, on the other hand, you know, fun issues. You can wear them upside down, side, you know, back to front. You have more than one outfit and one go. So it's kind of fun.
Well, I want to congratulate you again on winning the Pritzker Prize, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Architect Zaha Hadid. She'll receive the Pritzker Prize at a ceremony on Monday. You can see photos of her work at the website npr.org.
Thank you.
Music by the Bebo Valdez Trio. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD featuring Fred Anderson and Hamid Drake. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Fred Anderson and drummer Hamid Drake both come from Monroe, Louisiana, and are mainstays of Chicago's exploratory jazz scene. They met in 1973 when Drake was 18 and Anderson was 44, and quickly formed a working partnership. These days, Drake is on the road much of the time while Anderson stays at home, but they recently recorded as a duo. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Saxophonist Fred Anderson and drummer Hamid Drake have recorded together for ages. Back Together Again on Thrill Jockey is their first album one-on-one, though each has played in other duos. Drake says the format let them hone in on what they've developed together. Anderson has a rhythmic way of playing saxophone, while Hamid's percussion can almost spell out a melody, given the clear, ringing sound he gets from trap set and from big, tambourine-like frame drums. It's almost a case of role reversal. Fred Anderson has played a pivotal role in Chicago as a talent scout. He's run several bars that serve as musicians' training grounds, including the long-running Velvet Lounge. One reason he and Drake are simpatico is that Anderson helped mold the young Hamid's style 30 years ago, urging him to listen to drummer Edward Blackwell, a master of phrasing a melody along with the horns. Blackwell showed how drums could define the shape of a performance, not just lay down a beat. Like him, Drake laces his jazz with West African polyrhythms, to which Hamid adds echoes of North Africa. Fred Anderson is a transitional figure among Chicago saxophonists. He was a pioneering free jazz musician in the 60s, but he also harks back to brawny-sounding players reared in the swing era, like Gene Ammons. The CD Back Together Again comes with a CD-ROM, including three of the same tunes preserved on four-camera video. You can see how the players were arranged in the studio, close together and unseparated by sound baffles. You also see Fred Anderson's characteristic stance, hunched over his saxophone like a 1940s rhythm and blues honker. There are also excerpts from a double interview where the musicians talk about their shared history and concepts. That's all good. But the audio disc may be too much of a good thing. Hameed Drake knows a lot of rhythms and is a very interactive improviser, but here he tends to hit medium-tempo grooves and run with them. In the end, 72 minutes of grooving duets get redundant. By comparison, John Coltrane and Rashid Ali's tenor and drums album, Interstellar Space, recorded in 1967, was only about half that long. First rule of showbiz, often overlooked in the CD era, always leave them wanting more.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, The Absolute Sound, and Downbeat. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel about imposters, lovers, and strange Japanese animals, by the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Knopf, publisher of Eventide, the new novel by Kent Haroff, author of Plainsong. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Al-Qaeda has changed since the 9/11 attacks. We talk with Mark Sageman, author of Understanding Terror Networks. He's a forensic psychiatrist and a former CIA operative who was based in Pakistan from 1987 to 89. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.